So Scott, we're talking on this very podcast about running 200 miles, and you know, it's seemingly an impossible distance unless you have the tools.
You know, and we didn't talk about this on the podcast, but I'm interested in your shoe choice.
Yep.
And whether there is going to be a shoe change.
All right.
During the 200 miles.
So absolutely, let's talk about two of our favorite sponsors, and which make this podcast possible, and hopefully will make this run possible for me, and it comes down to it. And the fact that the things that we promote on this podcast are really in our heart and our soul, the things that we're
they
using.
They work.
And, yeah. And so I'm going to definitely use the Tailwind.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, many flavors, we get tired of flavors. I'm going to Naked because sometimes we get just tired of flavor, and we don't want it, but I still need those calories, and I still need that sodium and electrolyte.
And some of the caffeine. Into those wee hours of the night?
I need some of that. So I am definitely going to be Tailwind up for
sure.
I do know that when we talk about hydration, and full disclosure, sometimes I just like some water. You know, sometimes water just tastes good. And
yeah.
So I will mix some of that with water. And I could hear Jeff and Jenny right now over at Tailwind saying, then don't put two scoops in, just put one. You can change it up.
The beauty. Is when you're mixing your own, you can change it up.
Yeah. So we didn't even ask Candace what's being served on the tables, but I imagine it's standard fare out there, peanut butter and jelly and all the different foods and some crazy stuff. So I'm definitely going with the Tailwind, and I will carry some with me just in case, you know, I need some along the way. So I'll pack that in. Shoes. Without a doubt, the Ultra shoe. I've got to go with
that.
The Superior 2.0 is what I'm starting out with.
Yep.
It's my favorite shoe,
and
I want to start with my favorite shoe. I'm really happy with the wide toe box because I do know that something that can take you out is a blister. And the crazy thing about blisters is you can be a blister-free guy or gal, and all of a sudden, at mile 20, there's a blister. And it's like, I do 20 miles on the regular and never blister, and here I am at the beginning of this long race, and I'm blistering. How do I know that happens? Well, it's happened to me, but it's happened to others around me, and they're surprised. I have a blister. I don't blister. You never know what's going to happen. So definitely a wide toe box.
And it's going to be nice for you, you know, 200 miles being on your feet. Your feet are going to swell.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to swell. And to have that wide toe box so that your feet can move around and have a little bit of wiggle room is going to be a good, good thing.
So I'll be in the Injinji sock for that, and I'll also have that wide toe box. Now, I'm going to go get a pair of Olympus, which I haven't purchased before.
Those are the thicker sole. I have a pair.
Not
the right size.
My feet are going to swell, Scott.
We could do an Eric Strand, and I could cut the toes out, and it will fit you.
I may be doing that anyway. But I'm going to get a pair of those just for some extra cushion. I know that I've run hundreds before, and sometimes your feet just get beat up on the bottom. They just get tired and of getting pounded, and so that extra cushion will be nice. So I might slip a pair of those in, you know, at the 120 mark or in a drop bag or something.
Okay, so after the 100-mile mark.
Yeah, it'll be like my gift to myself.
Okay, surprise gift.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, the beautiful thing, even though that Olympus has a thick sole, it's still a zero drop. So you're going to be you're not going to be completely changing your running form because you're still going to be zero drop like all of the Ultra shoes, right?
Yeah. Now, one of the things, and anybody that's run long knows that pretty soon you start to slide a little bit your feet, not inside the shoe, but you shuffle and not so much the great, you know, running form because you get tired and you start kicking things. And when you have that thick sole, instead of kicking your toe, you kick the thick sole, and that is a gift. And I've been out there as anybody that's running the thick sole. It's all of a sudden you go bang, and you say, "Oh, that's gonna hurt." And you go, "Oh, it's the sole. I've got a big thick sole underneath me that's saving me." So, definitely gonna have something ready for me for a shoe change if needed.
So both of these companies carry products, sell products that we know work. That's why we support them. That's the reason why we're talking about them. Go to our partners page. Click on over, and if you haven't tried Tailwind, if you haven't tried a pair of Ultras, do yourself a favor and go try it.
That's what Candace runs in. She's an Ultra athlete.
She is.
Yeah. She knows what's going on.
She's a smart person.
She designed a 200-mile race.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure I'm happy about that.
It should be in the highly mandatory, not mandatory, highly encouraged equipment list.
Highly recommended.
A pair of Ultras and a large bag of Tailwind Nutrition.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
This might be one of the most interesting podcasts ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing. There's a bunch of like old brothel hookers like buried out here.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's
I do own my own bar. Every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything.
Can't you edit that?
No. Go.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Scott Warr.
I'm Lee McKinley.
And I'm not. I'm Don Freeman.
What are we doing today, Don?
Well, you know, we're here just to have a little discussion about a run.
You've been training hard. I know why.
Why is that?
It's because there's a little race up the hill in Lake Tahoe called the Tahoe 200. Our friend Candace Burt is the race director for that race.
Wow.
You're not really committing me to this on this podcast.
And
I am such, I can be swayed with peer pressure. And I have two friends sitting in front of me that are just doing exactly that.
Hey, Scott, I think that he can be swayed by just telling us about his run that he has planned for tomorrow.
Yeah, what are you doing tomorrow, Don?
No, I'm just going out for a run with some friends. It's called the FA 35, Fat Ass 35, and it's going to go from Cool, California, and it's going to run 35 miles.
And you don't do a 35 mile fun run or fat ass run just for the kicks. Right. You got to have a purpose behind that.
Yeah, I think that and, definitely.
And although Don has not come out and said the reason why he's been training so hard, I know the reason why.
You know, what is that, Scott? What would you tell me?
The Tahoe 200 has been eating at your soul for months.
What's the date on this race?
September 10th or so.
September 10th.
He knows the date. That so means that he's been looking at the website.
Yes,
it's about taper time.
It is the 12th of August. Wow. So we are less than a month out, and you're not signed up yet.
No, well, you know, there's last year I kind of did an impromptu 100-mile run with 15 miles as my longest run.
And did well.
And so this, I figure 200 miles, maybe 30 miles is necessary as a long run. I just to kind of keep things.
It has a lot of logic.
Now, Lee, you've been a mentor of mine a long time. Is there any logic to that?
Oh, I mean. So your long run will be 35 miles?
Yeah, the ratio works. Right? 15 is 100. 30 is 200.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before I answer that, do you have an altitude tent?
No.
So you're not getting used to the altitude?
No. No, but I've been...
You're just going to wing that.
He's been drawing small samples of his blood and refrigerating it. Mm-hmm. And right before the race, he's going to give himself some extra red blood cells.
It's the poor man's EPO.
Yeah, that's right.
So, Lee, speaking of that, you read a study on that some time ago that I remember talking to you on a run, and I thought it was fascinating, about some athletes, a blind study, right? So some athletes that had they'd all had some blood taken, and some received replenishment of their original blood. So they ended up with more red blood cells, and others didn't. And then they put them out there on a run, and they asked them, how did you feel, right? Can you kind of go over some of that? Do you recall? I've totally hit you without preparation.
Well, it goes without saying that the those that were received their blood back into their bodies did substantially better. I mean, there's no arguing the fact that by doing that, which we still think happens quite a bit today, right, puts you at an advantage that other athletes just don't. In fact, you can do that just days before a competition. There's no need to do it during training. You could just do it before the competition, and you have a baseline in your training. Race day, all of a sudden, you're at a level several steps up from that. So,
and as I recall, some of the comments were, I felt like I was running on a cloud. I could run all day. That's what I remember you saying. That stuck in my mind. And it wouldn't take much, really, right? A syringe, a bag, and a refrigerator.
That's right. Yeah. And apparently, again, back to the, I believe it not only runners, but cyclists were testing this also. And they were beginning to do some self-administering. You know, you literally, if you have a needle and a bag, you can draw this out, the blood out, and refrigerate it on your own. And some athletes have gotten into trouble doing this sort of thing. So it's interesting.
Isn't it dangerous? I think I read somewhere that if you're doing this and you're injecting, I don't know how much, what you would inject, an extra pint of blood into your system.
Well, Scott, the first thing, you better know how much, because it is dangerous if you don't know how much to take out or how much to put back.
I've only got up to a pint so far in my training.
Okay,
but at some point, I can assume that, you know, your blood vessels and your heart can only handle a finite amount of blood,
right.
That it maybe coagulates or gets thicker, or I don't know. There's got to be some danger there.
Yeah.
Well, the body shunts it off from different areas, you know, from the stomach to the limbs, and so it only has a finite amount, so it regulates where it goes. So I imagine there's room for some extra.
Is the reason we're talking about this is so that you can get some more blood cells, so when you're running the Tahoe 200,
I'm actually trying to change the subject because
you have more. You don't have to do the altitude training.
So Mac, you said you are getting ready for
nice change
for Kona, right?
You're changing the subject.
Allow me to go back to. I don't even ever remember having the conversation about this test of pulling blood out of patients. I think this was totally off the cuff to change the conversation.
It was.
So I went along with it, but no, let's bring this back to competition. So go ahead, Don.
Yeah, so you're getting ready for Kona, which means a lot. One of the things that I've admired about you, Lee McKinley, is that you do running, you swim, and you bike. And you, even when you were preparing for Western States, you did a third of each one of those activities just to keep yourself fresh so that you were excited about going out there and running. And I just think that is such a great strategy. Mm-hmm. What's behind it? What do you do? What have you noticed? You've done it both ways.
Mm. Well, so I am 55 now, so... it does mean that as we all get older, the body cannot tolerate the mileage.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen definitely in the last few years that the ability to mix it up, and especially mix it up defined as not so many running miles.
The pounding, is that what you mean? Your body can't handle the pounding.
That's right. And that's where I was going with this, that I think that older athletes can endure the mega swimming and the mega biking. And in fact, there are a lot of folks out there my age and older that are doing big miles on the bike and swimming. But the running, there just seems to be a ceiling as we get older. And so that's at least what I've bought into. And so far it's working. We'll see what happens in Kona, because I'm going to go in with some pretty low running miles.
How many running miles? Let's if you don't mind disclosing some of your the mileages. How much are you training for this?
Yeah. Well, so tomorrow will be 7 to 8 hours on the bike.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
Get off and probably just a 5-mile run after that. So the idea is to overtrain on the bike and undertrain on the run, even within those, what they call bricks. Probably most listeners know about what bricks are in the triathlon world. And so instead of getting off the bike and trying to run a big portion of the marathon part of the Ironman, it's just running a small portion, getting the body used to getting off the bike. And, you know, that incredibly horrible feeling of getting off the bike after a, you know, 100-mile ride and getting on those running shoes. So just getting used to that feeling and then shutting it down.
The first time that you trained this way, did it mentally kind of psych you out that maybe, you know, question whether you were able to do that kind of running with such a little bit of run training?
Yeah. And it did. It took a leap of faith, and it also took guidance from some professionals that are training that way too. Mark Allen, most people know that name.
Uh-huh.
The grip, they call him. That is the kind of training that he advocates and the kind of training that he did as he won the last 4 or 5 Konas that he did back in the 80s. So, I'm just following that kind of format, and it's proven to be successful for some top athletes.
So that applies very well to a triathlon event, but you actually did this for Western States, a 100-mile run, and with with fewer miles than traditionally we hear about. We hear about big miles. People are running 75 miles, 100-mile weeks to get ready for their big A race. And you did in the neighborhood of, as I recall, 30-mile weeks to get ready for that.
Yeah, that's correct. Does that pertain to everyone? I just don't know.
I don't know.
There are some runners out there that can really do that, and maybe you all are two of them right here that can tolerate those big miles.
No.
But I like the idea of getting a race day and knowing that the body isn't broken down. And it's that, you know, the mixing up, however you mix it up, doesn't have to be biking and running, whatever you're doing can get you there.
You know, I think that you have the advantage because you have a lot of experience running these long running races. Do you think that the same thing would apply to someone that's just getting into ultra distances and not knowing how the body is going to react to the pounding and to the blisters and to the unique specific things that happen running? I mean, you know what's going to happen because you've been there a bunch of times. Yeah. What do you think?
Boy, would I love to say no. I think that they can, a new runner can just hop right in and do that format. And I don't think so. Yeah, I think that a lot of what we are able to do by shortening the mileage, and, you know, we're joking with Don about how few miles he can run and still do the 100-mile, 200-mile.
Or 200-mile.
Yeah, well, that's yet to be seen.
Yeah. But all of that, right, is predicated on the historical miles that we've already put on. And there's just so much knowledge, whether we're conscious of it or not, right? I think that there are some physical changes that we go through that we're not even, you know, at the subliminal level that makes us capable of maybe doing what others can't at the same mileage.
So I will add to that some of these things that happen inside are thickening of ligaments and strengthening of the meniscus and the hip socket itself. I remember first starting out running and at mile 11 or 12, my hip sockets hurt. I mean, where my femur plugged into my pelvis, I felt pain in there.
Early in your running.
Yeah. Early in the running.
I think I remember that too. It's just,
and I remember the shin splints in the beginning, years 2 and 3. I don't even know why I was still running, but I enjoyed the company that I was with, and I wanted to get out there, but just
the peer pressure.
Yeah, still in effect today, and so there's a lot of things that need to harden up to be ready. There's certainly a mental side to learn the do's and don'ts and when trouble's coming and what to avoid. Because I could certainly sabotage myself if I want to. You know, I can go and not drink enough or not eat enough or go too fast in the beginning or attack hills or, you know, there's a lot of ways that I could sabotage that I've learned not to. And we all have, or we wouldn't be out there. But I think there's a lot of things that harden up internally.
Hey, I have a question for you, Lee. It's been probably 2 or 3 years and you started running in a high profile shoe, a lot of cushion and just thought it was the greatest thing.
We could say the name.
Hoka. Yeah. And to the point where Don and I ran out and bought a pair of Hokas and started running in Hokas. Are you still a proponent? Are you going to be running Ironman in Hokas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was an early adapter, wasn't I?
You were.
Yeah, you were.
But I didn't know that I was that outspoken with trying to get you guys on board. That's so funny.
All you need to do is say, this is what I'm running in, and Don and I, we don't need any pressure. We think, well, if Lee's using them, maybe we should get them.
Well, you know, truth be told, I know I didn't influence you guys very much because I've seen those running flats that you guys are running in. So, to answer your question, I still am a big Hoka fan. And in fact, I will plan on running in parallels.
Okay.
And so they've really broadened their spectrum of shoes. Now.
Yeah,
so
they have.
Racing flats, but the foundation of having that extra cushion is still there, and whether or not it's true or not, I've bought in mentally that helps the knees. So
yeah, interesting.
By the way, let me go back to what we were talking about with it.
Sorry.
The idea of mileage.
Could
there really be a flip side to this, that as we get a little bit older, we just cannot tolerate the miles, so we're justifying this idea of getting away with, in Don's case, running a 200 miler with 35 miles under his belt because our bodies are less able to do what a new runner can do. You know, I see these new runners come out and they're enthusiastic and their bodies are fresh and they can do the big miles, at least if they have a little bit of a base. And I just know I can't do it because of the fact that I've put so many miles on my body. So that's kind of the flip side of what we're talking about.
And you have a long-term plan on that. We've talked about it openly. You want to, for the next, you know, a number of decades, want to continue running. It's not like you want to check out in another few years. So you don't want to spend what's left.
That's right.
Your seven-year itch, is that what we're talking about?
I think that's a completely another topic, different topic.
No, wait, what's the
the Sawchuck 7.
Sawchuck 7. Yeah,
7-year itch.
I know that. I just thought I'd combine the two.
The Sawchuck 7.
Yeah, you have seven strong racing years whether you put them all
that's
together.
Right.
And that's we've right. talked about
or
it.
Or you can
times.
Do
it
3 years here, 4 years here.
Yeah, yeah. But you only have a finite number of races in your legs. That's
of top performance.
Top performance.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
And I have 7 years left. I really haven't chose to use any of my seven.
Yeah, I haven't started mine either.
They expire though. It's like one of those. There's an expiration date on it, so you've got to let them go at some point.
I wasn't told about an expiration date.
That's what gets you sometimes on
You know, Scott, that he has just cornered himself with a 200-miler. It's bound to be a stellar performance, right?
You guys are really pushing this. So let's talk a little bit about why someone would do a 200-mile run. I mean, if you really want to get down to it, unless you have something else, Scott.
No, I have a comment on that, but let's answer your question first.
Let's just talk.
I want to know why you're intrigued with the 200-mile distance.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And so let's kind of throw it around why other runners might be, why you guys are going to consider it as well.
See how he spun that?
Oh, and he's so good at that.
But you know what? I know that one of the two of you will pull the trigger, whether it's this year or next year. And I think there's a lot to like about it.
It's a lot slower.
Yes.
I mean, you don't have to go as fast as 100 mile.
Right.
I mean, if you're doing a 24-hour 100 mile, what is that like? Faster than 4 minutes a mile? Isn't that right?
Well, I haven't done the math. I'm not really.
But a 200-miler, you're not finishing a 200-miler. I mean, unless you're going to win the thing in 48 hours.
Well, we need to look and see what the finishers' times are. I think they're in the 60 to 70-hour range.
Right. But I actually think Scott's point about what is it really like to run 200 miles versus even a 100-miler, because I had misconceptions about what that's all about. So paint that picture.
Well,
here's one
of the crazy things, right? At the Santa Barbara 100-miler, maybe not this year, but last year, because I was going to try to get down there to do that, 45% completion rate. It's exposed, there's a lot of hill climbing. I mean, there's something. There's a demon out there. I don't know. They kidnap you and put you in a bag and beat on you. I don't know what they do to make 45%. And some good names, some good athletes. It's not like everybody's first time running. They didn't, you know, get the a group of 5Kers and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, this is a 100-miler." And as I recall, it is an 85% completion rate.
Come on.
Yeah. We'll look that up to verify.
For the Tahoe 200?
Yeah.
It's pretty high. I remember looking at it one time, and I thought it was pretty high.
So let me put these together here. You're saying that the San Diego 100 has a 40-some percent finishing rate, half the distance.
Yeah, the Santa Barbara, half the distance,
Santa
45%.
Barbara.
So let's break that down. Why would that happen? Is that where you're going? Go ahead, Mac.
That's fascinating. Well, so I think I want to defer that back to you, being the man that's training for the 200-miler.
I do have the finish time for the 2015 Tahoe 200, 60 hours and 57 minutes.
Yeah,
60 hours. Is a finish winning time. 60 hours.
Guy named Jim Trout from East Grand Rapids, Michigan.
So given that a winning 100-mile time would be in the 17-hour, 16 to 17, so you're doubling and then adding quite a bit. So we're talking about slowing down significantly over the duration.
And there's also sleep. I mean, what is your strategy behind sleep there, Freeman?
Well, traditionally, I just sleep along the trail, but this run has six sleep stations.
Sleep stations.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. So they.
And what are the sleep stations? What do you bring your own bedding or what?
I think she accommodates you.
Yeah, I don't think you have to carry your own sleeping bag.
No, she has some blankets for you, and I think some hotel soaps and shampoos.
She's been collecting hotel soaps for a year
along the way. Yeah.
And obviously that's optional, and I wonder how many people take advantage of those sleep stations.
Well, so some good strategies behind that, but let's back up for just a second. That I think the 85% finisher rate is exactly that reason, slowing down, slowing way, way down, and how much you can really do if you don't bust out of your zone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what intrigues me about the 200 is that you have the absolute permission to go slow, and it is mandatory. And as I spoke about earlier, I can sabotage myself pretty well, but in this instance, 200 miles, do not sabotage yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so here's an amazing stat. At the 2015 Tahoe 200, of the 55 people that started.
Brave runners, yes. Courageous.
53 finished.
How about that?
Only two people did not finish the
race. How about that? Now, are you going to tell us who didn't finish?
And the person that came in last, I'm not going to. Actually, I will say his name. Eric Hanley. From Wisconsin, he finished just under 100 hours.
How about that?
Yeah.
Mm. Mm.
So only two people didn't finish. Does that kind of give you a little bit of pressure, Freeman?
That really adds to the pressure, right? So only two people didn't get it done, and I'm out there in the middle going, 100's enough, right?
That's... yeah, yeah.
And how about this? Here's what concerns me. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Mac. You have something to say?
Well, so I had a vision of these sleep stations. And and so let's say this, you say there are six.
Yeah.
And so you get to the sixth one. And so you made it that far through this 200 miler. And you're thinking about dropping out. But you get to the sleep station and you get this time to sleep, right? You get to lay down and recover and do whatever it takes to get your body back together. Compared to a 100 miler, most people that reach that point, they're up against a cutoff time, right? Mm-hmm. And so you may be able, in 100 mile, you may be able to sit in the proverbial cot for 15, 20 minutes, but then you've got to get up and go where, if I'm getting the picture right, in the 200 miler, the difference might be that you have this grand amount of break time if you choose to take advantage of it.
You could take a couple hours and take a nap.
Mm.
So,
or multiple hours.
So yeah.
I want to get back to what you think you're going to need for this. What's your strategy on sleep? Do you think that you're going to just play it by ear, or when you come to the first sleep station, are you going to take advantage and take a 3-hour nap?
So mm-hmm. let's address that. But here's what worries me.
Is he changing the subject?
No, I'm not. I'm not changing the subject about the sleep station, because how many times when you guys have finished a 100-mile run or even a 50-mile run, after you get off your feet for 15 or 20 minutes, how do you look like a runner?
Coagulated.
You look like, somebody that's just had two hip replacements and you've been, Guido has visited you and played a song on your shins.
Yeah.
And so what do you do about that?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember one of my 100 milers, I laid down on the cot for a couple of minutes and I can remember my crew standing over me as I had my eyes closed. And they were talking about me as though I had passed on to the next world and say, okay, let's get things packed up because he doesn't look good. And
Chantry Flat.
He's not leaving Chantry Flat, yeah. And so that's just validating your point.
So what is the strategy? How long do you stay for a very short time? Do you go for a long time? And I've heard some say it's the 20-minute nap.
Power nap
revitalizes the brain is really why you're sleeping.
Who's the, I lost his name. Who's the jester? The jester runner that runs in the jester outfit?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I remember him coming in. He was running Rio del Lago. I was in an aid station, working an aid station. He came in, and this guy's run a lot of hundreds.
He's a good runner, yeah.
And he came in, and he sat down in a chair, and he said, can you give me 20 minutes? He says, if I haven't woken up in 20 minutes, can you come please wake me up?
Interesting, yeah.
And he sat there in a chair, bowed his head, and he was out for 20 minutes. And almost to the T, I was getting ready to go over and wake him up, and he woke up on his own, and he got up, and he ran out of the aid station.
Yeah, yeah.
When we were lucky enough to be at Hard Rock and speak with David Horton, and he talked about what needs rest is the brain. The brain is creating all of the electrical impulse to make the muscles work and the heart pound, and all that stuff is generated from the brain. And we know when we look at calories expended within the body, it's surprising how much the brain uses in caloric intake. It's just amazing. And he says, below the neck, that can go forever. It doesn't need rest. It's the brain you need to power down to revitalize so you can keep going.
Right.
And so
you're thinking maybe after a 2-hour, 3-hour rest, that even though you're going to stand up and you're going to be as stiff as a board,
that your mind is more revitalized and can get you through that.
Makes sense.
That stiffness.
Yeah. That 20-minute nap could be as much a mental nap as a physical nap.
Yeah. I'm wondering if I could get a masseuse just to keep me loose and limber while I'm sleeping, because I'm certain I can sleep during a massage at that point.
Not some of those monster massage type. Those things hurt.
Where the elbows are going through the muscle itself?
Yeah. Mm.
So the strategy on sleep. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah. So I do think sleep is a cornerstone of the high success rate, but I also think that if you are able to go slower, what about one's ability to digest food, right? Because so much of the problems that we encounter out there in these 100-milers is GI related.
Right.
And so, I don't know, in a 200-miler, would you suspect at a lower rate?
I think GI disturbance or distress comes from pushing the envelope beyond mm-hmm. where we're comfortable and capable.
You never had GI problems at your last 100, did you?
Not at that one, but Lee McKinley has been a close witness to some GI disturbance.
Did you have to hold his hair back?
No, and we passed another set. So Mac was my pacer, and we passed another set of running team where the runner was, you know, clearing his stomach out. And his pacer was cheering him on and patting him on the back and go, come on, man, you can do it. Mac, he didn't do any of that to me. He said, come on, Freeman, get that out. Catch up to me.
You're wasting time here.
That's
and then
right.
Have another goo.
Can't you do that while you're walking?
Yeah. Sign of a true athlete.
So I think the fact that slowing down is just going to remove a lot of that GI distress stuff. Yeah. And I think it's going to be, in ways, it could be easier than 100.
Mm-hmm.
Because a marathon can be tougher than a 100-mile run. I would be fearful of putting 100% into a marathon. You could really go through a lot of pain, discomfort, and bonk, and all the terrible things that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And 100 miles, a little more stretched out, might be easier. So 200 might even be easier than 100, I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't done the math here.
Apparently, I haven't either. Go ahead.
But maybe Lee can, because he's the smartest of the three of us. Could you walk this thing in 100 hours?
It's you know what? I think it's pretty close to, if you walk, 3.1 miles an hour or something like that, it allows zero time for anything else. I think that's the brilliance of the number that Candace has picked, because I think it could be done, because I think I did some math, but you had to walk steady through the whole thing. So any break time you want.
And there's some altitude changes there too, some hills that you'd have to... It would have to average out to be that 3.1 or whatever.
So if you want to make it by cutoff for the race, you need to do some running, because you need some break times in there.
Because walking 20-minute miles, we can do that, right, if we just go out for a walk. But even that's not easy. You have to be, just to walk a 20-minute mile, you have to be very deliberate. So I cannot imagine, to your point, that you could do this without running. Yeah.
You know, one of the other questions I have for you as you encounter and attempt this race, Freeman, is
you guys
poles,
assuming I'm
trekking poles?
Poles. Yeah.
I think I should probably get some. I have some. You can borrow mine. There's a huge advantage. We've talked to people. Andy Jones Wilkins just talked about how he used trekking poles at Hard Rock and how it made a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you're going to have to get some trekking poles and get out and train with them.
And not just any. They make these carbon fiber. That are super ultra light. Yeah, are you talking about that?
That's one I have, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Do they fold up or are they just...
Oh, no.
I have some that fold up and some that telescope. I have two pair.
Ooh. So I'm seeing the excuse list is getting shorter and shorter for why, Don.
The purpose of this podcast is eliminate excuses for Freeman to register for Tahoe 200.
Uh-huh. You know, I edit this thing, right? It could be like a 3-minute podcast. We're just talking about Lee and his running, and his running exploits and his prep for Kona.
But I do like where this is going with it. You know, intensity equals a higher percentage of a chance of not finishing the event that you're in, right?
Right.
And this 200 miler has its own challenges, but if you have the base level of endurance and training, which you don't, but if everybody else in the race does,
well, I have to. We're painting a picture that Don has not been out there running. He's been out there running quite a bit.
Has
in fact, he? He's in. He's been trying to get me to do the new route that he daily route that he does, which is
down a hill, up a hill, down a hill, up a hill, and is it correct at the bottom of the hill you do push-ups?
Right.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a mile and a half down and a mile and a half up, and
mm-hmm. he's been working mm-hmm. that pretty mm-hmm. hard. So yeah. His base has been there for
a little while.
Nine months, ten months.
So I've been trying to build off last year's race. So why else would a person consider doing a 200 miler? I mean, what is it that would intrigue you, Scott or Lee, to do a 200 mile run? Because I see a little bit of a twinkle in your eye as we've, and a little,
I'll think, say jealousy. I think that, you know, I'm going to try to answer for Lee.
Yeah, you should, and then he can answer for you. Yeah.
Is Lee enjoys fast packing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's great.
And I think
that
this is very close to fast packing, right. Although you don't have to take all your gear with you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's...
Is that the case, by the way? I was envisioning, again, it sounds like a misnomer, that there, I was thinking that you had to carry gear.
There is a minimum requirement. I'll look that up here, but there is you have to carry a minimum requirement of equipment with you. Mm-hmm. I know one of those is you have to carry a spot GPS locator mm-hmm. so they can keep track of you wherever you are.
But not much is what you're saying.
Not much, no. Mm-hmm.
Not a tent.
I'll look that up, but I want to hear your answer. What intrigued you to do this? It's not too late. Kona is when?
Kona would maybe be a week afterwards or something.
That's perfect. It'd be great taper.
Yeah, thank you. You know you have good friends when they try to talk you into that kind of a thing. But yeah, I think if you know, the all hypothetical, if I were ever to be interested in that distance, it would all spring from the fact that it is like that backpacking, just like you stated. So having done some fast packing, that's it's not only fun, but it's very challenging. And this sounds very similar.
There are some participants that are primarily hikers that go out there to do it, not just all ultra runners. So she gets a mix of just people that are in shape and fit.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that's what it takes. Just have a body that is in shape.
Yeah.
Okay,
go ahead.
I have the recommended gear list for the Tahoe 200.
Let's go through and because here's what
we need to see if you have all the stuff first.
Okay.
Right.
I think you may. A waterproof rain jacket with a hood.
Yeah.
Plastic bags plastic bags don't count. So you have what's the jacket you have?
The Houdini. For Patagonia. But if I just went out there with a hefty bag and put three holes in it?
You can't do that.
Okay.
Long sleeve insulating shirt, wool or microfiber, no cotton. This is recommended.
Okay.
Waterproof pants. We need to get you a pair of pants.
Yeah. Interesting.
A hat, gloves.
Got gloves.
Water purification method.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Tablets, filter, SteriPen. Mm-hmm. We have you covered there.
Iodine.
List of emergency contacts with allergies and medical conditions listed under laminate level.
Where do I put that?
You need a headlamp.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that you've tried to attempt 100 milers without headlamps, so we'll make sure that we have one of those. One set of extra batteries, which is also something that we know you've forgotten.
Thank you.
This is on the recommended gear list. $20 cash or a debit card. We'll need to work on that. You can start saving now.
Yes.
Ability to carry a minimum of 40 ounces of water.
Yeah, two bottles.
Yeah.
So that's recommended.
Is there any mandatory? You got to love this about the race director. She's not going to give you any mandatory. She's just going to...
It says recommended gear... To carry at all times, all is capitalized. Please keep in mind that we will be traversing mountains and weather, la, 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 la. This is for your own safety and the safety of your fellow runners. If something were to go wrong during the race, with this gear, you'll be more prepared to help yourself through or your fellow runners. So I think that although it says recommended, it sounds like it's you're an idiot.
She might not. Right. Now, do you think that she's turning applicants away? In other words, are there people that... A lot of people that are trying to get into this, that she may be saying, look, you know, great thought, but you clearly need to have more on your resume.
So do you think that's perhaps why she has a finish rate of 85%? Mm-hmm. A careful screening could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to know.
Well, there is qualifying criteria. Mm. There are three options. You have to complete one 100-mile mountain race or longer.
Within a 12-month period or just period?
One of the three options listed below for qualifying. For 2016, qualifying races must be completed between September 9th, 2013 to present.
Interesting. Okay.
So you have to
do a 100-mile mountain race that has 15,000 feet of climbing, or complete two 200-mile non-mountain races or longer, defined as less than 15,000 vertical feet, or the race director approval.
How about that?
That's always good.
Yeah. So two 200-milers would work. It's like, okay.
Or just get approval from Candace.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go for a good story and see if she'll let me in.
Yeah.
You also have to do 8 hours of trail work, which you have.
I've done. Yeah.
That's in the bank.
Good. All right. So why would you want to run it, Scott?
Yeah.
Scott? I don't. Not yet. I would do it. I think I would consider it after watching what you go through.
There you go. Yeah.
There's something that drags another person in once you've watched some suffrage, right?
I think that's one of the things that intrigues me most about this sport, and the reason why I decided I wanted to even do some of this stuff is watching runners at the end of a race, whether it's a 50K or a 50-miler or the 100-mile distance. To see what people go through during the race and after the race. That intrigues me. And I want to know if I have what it takes to do what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to observe the guinea pig first before
so really hats off to the first inaugural run when people hadn't done it.
Yeah.
And it was the first ever, you know, so they're going in uncharted waters. Now we could see, well, others have gone before us and even people that we know. And
I'm thinking local runner Jenny Capel did this as a solo runner, but just maybe the year before they made this a race.
Victor Ballesteros, he came in podium finish on this last second or third place.
Yeah, there's been a lot that have done the FKT of the Tahoe.
Just circumnav- as a solo.
Navigation.
Yeah.
Huh. And we just had some friends that did it last summer as a kind of a fat ass race, if you will. There were three or four women that did it. And I think it was self-supported. I don't think they had people out there.
Huh.
I think they had their packs on.
I'm only laughing at that. You're saying those three women were fat ass runners?
No. Look, you can edit that out, huh, Freeman?
Yes, you can bet it won't be on
the
podcast.
Sure. Luckily, they don't
listen
to the podcast.
Done. You can count on me.
Yeah, you can count on me.
Yeah, so I think you guys are pushing me closer to committing to it. I think that you're right. There's a window of opportunity. So whether you're planning to do a 50-mile or 100-mile or even a 200-mile, you have to look to see, is this a time in my life that I can pull this off? And there's a lot of things that need to be in place. One, you have to have time to train. You have to have the health to train. You have to have the health to race it. You can't let things in life will come along that will take you out of that opportunity. You might have a problem with a knee or a foot. Some of these things happen to people that are going along smoothly just fine. All of a sudden, dang, I can't run on this. I have some plantar fasciitis now. What's going on?
That's right. So you have to have done your research to see how many people in your age group, i.e., what does the competition look like? So I'm hoping Scott's doing a little research on that, too, to see. You're 55, right?
No, I'm not. I'm less than you. You know that.
I'm
a younger man than
you. He's older than me. I'm the young guy.
Yeah, that's good. So you should sign up for this.
So I'll sign up as a crew member and
there you go.
Short pacer.
So Brad Kearns had asked me, so why are you considered doing this? And I said, because that window of opportunity is open, and I need to jump through it now.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have a retort for that. He was like, I guess that makes sense. So I thought, well, maybe that does make sense. Maybe I'll hold on to that as rationale why I would do this. Mm-hmm. And have you seen the belt buckle you get?
No.
Maybe that's the reason for doing it.
It says 200 on it.
All right.
Well, of course it's going to say 200.
What the heck? That's reason enough.
We're envisioning something large.
is it bigger than a typical house plate?
It's a normal size. But speaking of big belt buckles, how about Bill Finkbeiner's that came from Leadville? That thing was like a turkey platter that he wore.
That's awesome.
That's nice. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that big. It's not as big as a lake. So, gentlemen, you think it's something that's doable. What would you caution me with? If you're my friends, if you're truly both my friends, and I count you one on each hand, as dear friends.
Let me start.
Yeah.
I would caution you about waiting too long to sign up.
Now, that's not a friendly.
He's serious. He's not laughing.
It could close.
I'm laughing.
You should go to Ultra Sign Up, see if it's still open for one.
Yeah, and while he's doing that, I will say, you know, when I speak to wannabe athletes or wannabe ultra runners, mm-hmm. and they ask me advice on, you know, how do you get motivated to run any of these races?
Yeah.
And how do you get motivated to go out there and do all this training? Well, number one thing is sign up for a race. That there's no greater motivator than putting your name on the line. So if you do that, given that it's actually time for you to taper for the race, I don't know how much this will impact you, but sign up today, hopefully right when we're done with this podcast. And
or how about right now?
Scott, you know, there's nothing like a bit of peer pressure. Don't you have to get out of here, Lee McKinley? What's what time do you have to exit?
Are you changing the subject again? I'm going through and registering you, and I just want to let you know that I've released all liability, and you've already read the entire runner's manual, which I know you do thoroughly before each race.
What did you put in the section where they ask, what do you want me to say about you at the finish line?
I put, I'm a stud. Is that okay?
Good. So we are implying that he's going to make it to the finish line. That's good.
Yeah. Well, 85.
There's a lot more stuff. You have to write a little bit more of an essay here.
Okay. Well, I should probably handle my own sign up.
You have to rent a spot, or if you don't have one, you need to get one.
You know, Scott, am I right in remembering that Don is capable of getting away with very little sleep? And if I'm right on that, that this place...
I don't think so.
It's the first I've heard about it.
He's a proponent. He is a sleep advocate.
Oh,
yeah, I'm big on sleep. I think we should do it daily.
This is,
and twice if possible.
I thought this is the guy that's out running all night long.
I do like to run at night, which will happen here. So it looks good. You guys have really talked me into it.
Hey, cool. I just want to talk to Lee real quick about his upcoming Kona. This is... What number, Kona?
Third
mm-hmm. Kona. Uh-huh. And did you did it last year, right?
2 years ago.
2 years ago is when you did it.
Yeah.
So what do you expect different from this Kona versus 2 years ago? Any expectations that are different, or training execution things that are different?
So I'm hoping for a better day from race. The conditions are pretty tough in 2013. There were some, I think Japan had a typhoon that was blowing off in... It affected the swim and the bike. The trade winds on the bike were just unbelievable that year. So with any luck, we have a better day. But what's kind of fun is that I'm in a new age group. So I'm 55, and so that gives me a chance as a 55 in different than ultra running. There are 5-year age groups in Ironman. So, being competitive is maybe a little bit important to me. So
do you know how many are competing in that age group?
Oh, good question.
How many people compete at Ironman Kona?
2,500.
Oh wow!
And there might
That's
be
a big group.
Might be 500 in my age group, something like that. So 300, let's say.
Okay, so it's a big big group.
It's not like I am any possibility of winning that age group, but certainly to be competitive, that would be the goal. So yeah, being a little bit older certainly helps.
And you've done well in your age group. At Kona last year, how did you do?
No, it was just it's just average. Yeah, really.
Oh, you're so modest. He did very well.
You have to look it up.
No.
He did better than average.
So whether you're looking at a 200-mile run, 100-mile run, 50-mile run,
an Ironman,
or just going out for a long Saturday run for an hour or more, it's within everyone's reach as long as you go out with a strategy. Don't overrun, because. Mm-hmm. I could certainly bonk in an hour run if I put myself out there to do that. So measuring your effort and making sure you take care of the essential items, nutrition and taking care of yourself, extremely important.
And I'll add to that adjusting for the conditions. So good, exceptional running experience friends who go out in the heat of the day. And if they're not adjusting for that heat, I don't care how good a shape they're in. It's going to be to their demise.
I have a race day question quick for you, Lee. When you start, regardless of the race distance, do you always start out slower than you would prefer, just so you can kind of feel how the day is going to unwind and then slowly speed up?
Mm-hmm.
Or in your experience with many, many races, do you still go out too fast?
Well, first of all, I want to say that, no, I'm whether or not I follow through with what I say is a whole other thing, but I totally am a believer in starting out slowly. But I am fascinated by, let's say, the guys that are vying for top 10 at Western States. If you interviewed all top 10 of those guys, most of them, I believe, would say, I'm going to go out at the fastest pace that I think is going to take to win it. And if I don't succeed in holding that, then I call it a day and I say I try my best to win it. So that concept of putting it on the line like that is, you know, obviously full of risk, but it's fascinating to see him do it.
Yeah.
And so it's not something I ever do. I try to really, it's all about finishing. So definitely start slow.
What was that thing we talked about some time ago, Mac, about the string? Remember, don't go over the line.
Yeah.
What was that concept? And then we'll wrap up here, because I know you have a training block to do, a couple of bricks.
Yeah.
What was that? What was that? That point?
Yeah, that was an article that was written by a famous triathlete, and it held so much wisdom, and it was all tied to the fact, and I apologize, this is going to really tie back to the Ironman, but I think there are things we can pull into running, is that for the Ironman, it's not about the swim, it's not about the bike, it is all about the run.
Mm.
And so the whole day has to be about focusing on how you want that run to develop, and then backing into that, meaning that during the swim, during the bike, everything that you do is geared toward being able to run the pace that you want to in the marathon. And so I think that ties in. I forget how they used the line, but I think that was a point in the race where when you reach the line, you keep the pace that you've been going or are able to speed up. Do I remember
right?
Correctly?
Yeah, you have to protect yourself to the line where you need to manage your effort, mm-hmm. and then there is at some point where you're allowed to then let it go and start to move a little bit quicker and disregard this management to that extreme where you're holding back.
No, that's right.
You're allowed to let it roll out a bit.
Yep.
But you have to take care of yourself absolutely and not break any of your rules that you have until the line.
So in a triathlon, you're saying that line is getting off the bike and putting on your running shoes.
Well, as I described it, I could see why you think that. Actually, it was amazingly late into the marathon that this author described that. And it was actually, I believe it was mile 17 of the marathon, said that everything that you do all day is built toward that point in the marathon where when you hit the line, and he gave his definition of that being around 16 or 17, that's the point where you do not slow down.
So the last 6 miles is what you're building for.
That's right. That's right.
Wow.
And by the way, I applied that at Ironman Tahoe with great success. I mean, I followed that, and it seemed crazy to think that you would wait that long. But it's also interesting to see how much people slow down, right? From mile 15, 16, for a lot of people, it's a walkathon from that point.
Yeah.
Do you think that the same thing would apply to a 50-mile or 100-mile race? And where do you suggest or expect that to happen?
Mm. You tell me. Well, what do you think? It would seem to me that it'd be a great strategy to apply, but I don't know where. I don't know.
You know, it depends on the race. I mean, we've always talked about, you know, we talked probably ad nauseum about Western States on this podcast, but we know that Forest Hill is where the race starts.
Yeah. 62.
Yeah. And so I think it would probably depend on the race. What do you think, Don Freeman?
Depends on the race, depends on the runner. You know, I think if you try to just unload it all the way at mile 62, not many people can do that. That's too much. But it certainly speaks to the point for at least Western States. There's a lot of canyons before that. And I think that rule of thumb is don't hurt yourself before the race really starts to move, you know, really hold back. So, and that goes for any race profile look at, you know, we just talked about that race, but yeah, measuring your efforts. It's going to be key for a 200 mile effort. That's for sure. We'll see what happens.
All right. He's in.
One of the common themes that we've always talked about on Trail Runner Nation, and it's come out, I think, in this podcast is find a mentor. And find somebody that has been there and done that, that you can log some miles with and learn from their wisdom. I know that Don has learned from Lee. I've learned from Don, and it's trickled down from there. And I'm sure Lee learned from many, many more experienced runners than he.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the fun things about running these trail runs and ultra runs, and is that community yeah. that's willing to help.
That's right.
Well, I appreciate you, Lee McKinley, for trekking on down here and sharing some time with us.
My pleasure.
And we need to get out on the trail and mm-hmm. run a bit as soon as you mm-hmm. Get done with this Kona. When's mm-hmm. that date coming up?
October 8th.
October 8th.
And mm-hmm. what's the date of Tahoe 200?
Well, it spans over a period of time. We mm-hmm.
What's the start date?
We block off a calendar. I know that's somewhere around the 9th of September through the 12th or 13th or something. It's in that week. Mm-hmm. Sign up for a race that has several days attached, and you know you've got yourself something to hold on to. So we just finished the first part of a podcast, and during that podcast, we were going to sign Don Freeman up live
right.
for the Tahoe 200, because he's been toying with this thing for months, we can't get a commitment out of him. We thought, Lee and I were thinking, if we can get him to sign up on a podcast, then he's committed.
You know, you guys are real good friends. I got to tell you that, because what else could be a friend if not signing you up for 200-mile race?
So we were having a little bit of technical difficulties, and I texted while we were doing the podcast. I texted the race director, Candace Pert.
Yeah,
and she didn't respond. And I was thinking, we've offended Candace. We're no longer friends with Candace. Well, it just so happened you were marking the course for Bigfoot 200. Which yeah. just finished last week, right?
Oh boy, I'm trying to remember. Yeah, it was just over a week ago. Yeah, and so I was on. We had an 8-day course marking schedule that didn't have a single day off, and it had like 25-mile days, 15-mile days, and we also had rain, which luckily we didn't have for the race, but it was super intense. So we didn't have reception that whole time we were out there. We were literally in the boonies with, no phone. So I got your message when I got back.
2 days later. And, yeah. and so I have a question about course marking a 200-mile race and being out 8 days to mark a course. That's freaking, that blows my mind that you guys are out on the course for 8 days marking a course for these few lucky runners that are going to run this race.
It's true. It's a lot of work for, usually it's around 100 people for the 200s. And so part of the reason it takes us so long is we're going about 2 miles an hour. We'll have like 30, 40 pound packs filled with wooden stakes, signs, and then what we call dragons, which are basically a clothespin with ribbons hanging from it and reflectors on them. And we have those strung on strings that we wear around our, we look like a Halloween costume almost, but we figured out like the best way to wear them so you can easily put the markers up as you go, and then you have a bunch stuffed in your pack. And then I also like to carry a 2-pound hammer, because it puts the stakes in the ground easier. I get made fun of, but it works better, and it's a big stapler. So what ends up happening is it ends up taking just a lot of time. So a 20-mile day could be a 10, 12-hour day.
So you're talking about the time to mark the course. How about cleaning up the course afterwards? Yeah. I mean, that's a considerable amount of work too.
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, this year we really focused on our volunteer coordinating to make sure there was a person at every aid station who would follow the last runner, not closely, but within like a safety distance, in case a lot of times the people who are in the back of the very back of the pack, there'll be issues going on. Maybe they're feeling sick or they have a little injury issue, and that's why they're that far back. And so they're sort of like a safety sweeper, but they also pick up the ribbons. So this year we had somebody behind every section just to make sure that if there was a problem out on course, our sweeper would be out there and they'd catch it. And that was, that was great. Especially on a course that's so remote, like Bigfoot, you can't, you can watch the spot devices and see where somebody is, but to know if they're okay can be hard to tell.
So those people are not only being safety, but they're also cleaning the course markings?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good strategy.
It's a hard job.
So how do you keep track of all of these people that are out there? I heard you mention the spot, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but just communicating.
We need to get you a spot.
Communicating to the
yeah,
aid.
We do.
Communicating to the aid stations. How do you, as race coordinator, command central, reach out to an aid station at mile 74?
Well, boy, are we lucky with Bigfoot. We have this whole ham radio crew who they absolutely love to do ham radio. And it's sort of a lost art, I think, in some ways. But they set up these huge wire towers. I'm sure there's a name for it, at every aid station. And so we have one volunteer who knows how to run the ham. And they then radio back to Central Command, which is at the finish line. And then we have walkie-talkies that, so we can talk to the hams from wherever we are at the finish line, because we may be within a half mile of them, but there's a lot going on at the finish line. So we all have special names too for the walkie-talkies. And it's a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun with it, but and the ham shack, we called them.
I like that, the ham shack.
Yeah, they actually came up with it themselves, the ham or the hammy shack. So we just had a great time with it, but having a communication person at every single aid station, and then also having, we use Track Leaders, which is a website where you can look at a map and see exactly where everybody is on it, based on their spot or DeLorme device that they're wearing. So that's the most accurate way to follow them. And then we also do splits through ultralive.net. But those are a little bit more delayed, so we say it's more to look at your splits after the race. But I have one person whose sole job it is at the finish line to deal with the ham radios, the ultra live track leaders, and all the people that are, you know, in dealing with those people, because there's websites and everything we have to manage.
So, Candace, how did you go about wanting to become a race director and then getting sophisticated enough to pull this 200-mile thing off? This seems to be something that you just, I don't know how you went about doing it.
I don't know either, honestly, because before I put on the first 200, I had never, the longest race I'd really organized myself was like a 50K. So I know that there was definitely...
go big or go home, Don.
Yeah.
I guess so.
But I think that I did sort of find something that I'm pretty good at. And I researched a lot of what other races do. And I really put in, you know, a full-time job all year to put on the first Tahoe 200. And we've definitely honed it. Like, it's way better now than it was in 2014. And it will be better in, you know, 2020 than it is in 2016. But we really pulled it off without a single hitch this year at the Bigfoot.
So what are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned, just or maybe just one or two, that you've learned that the 200-mile distance to direct is different than any other distance?
I think it's even more important to be as prepared as possible before the event. And when I say before the event, I mean like the whole week before. You have to make schedules out. Who's doing what, when course marking's happening, when the shopping's happening. And then the second thing would be having the right people who are on your volunteer and paid crew. So I have a lot of paid people, and I also have a lot of people who, you know, put in time just for their own fun. And, you know, those are the people that really make this event what it is. I can only influence so many people, but if I have the right crew on hand, then we all have a good time and nobody has to do too much work. and the runners are well babysat, which is sort of what we're doing.
Dang, I forgot. I had a really good question.
Well, we determine if it's good.
I know. In my mind,
it's
I
good.
Can,
okay.
I can say it's a good question. So I saw a picture that Howie Stern took, and we actually posted it on our website, of Reed Glesny. Is that how you say his name?
I think so. 64-year-old
man finished Bigfoot 200 a couple weeks ago. And my question was, what has been your probably the most inspirational finish that you've seen at either Bigfoot or Tahoe 200?
That's a good question, Scott.
That is.
Thanks. Yeah.
That is. It's hard to say because I mean, I guess from my perspective as the race organizer, I'm seeing everybody come through the finish line, and I make sure that I'm at the finish line for each finisher. And so I don't necessarily see some of the inspirational stuff that's happening at the aid stations. But there's definitely two things that come to mind. One was this year, we had a runner go out. So it was actually on the third section of trail leading up to mile 30, where one runner actually ran a mile ahead to get water for another and then ran a mile back because one of the runners was, and this was, he ran to like one of the fresh spring waters and then back because they knew, we mark all the water sources on the course too, so he knew where to go. But one of the runners was suffering, you know, and needed more water. So that, to me, like, to sacrifice your race a little and to realize it's not just about you, it's not about setting a time, it's about a community, that's always really inspiring. That's the biggest thing. And then last year at the Tahoe 200, Kent Dozier, I remember he was watching the live results coming in, and our last guy was probably not going to make the cutoff. He was going to be really close. And so Kent ran like 4 miles out at high speed, and he had just finished his 200 miler, and he sprinted up the ski hill. I'm not even kidding. This guy's fast. Like, you know, if he's not running a 200, he's a fast runner, but he took off after 205 miles and he caught the guy and he just pushed him all the way back. And, it made for a really inspiring finish. We always get so excited about those last runners.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of you guys at the finish line, and you are at every finisher's finish, and as a director.
Yeah, just about. Every once in a while, one gets in when I'm, you know, like taking a brief nap or you know, something. But yeah, I got everybody this year though.
Oh, that's very cool.
So tell us about the Tahoe 200. It's coming up here in 2 weeks. What is the preparation right now? Where are you in getting things all ready to go?
Because you're fresh back from Bigfoot. Right. I mean, you're
3 hours of sleep, she said.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just got back like a few hours ago. I've never done this. I drove 18 hours straight. I stopped to use the bathroom and I stopped to get gas, but and to walk, you know, Hank the dog, but it was like 18 hours straight. It was crazy. So like right now, basically making sure there aren't any loose ends that aren't getting tied. So at some point we were like, oh wait, did we not order the medical? So we get shirts for the medical volunteers. So little details like that, making sure that everything's been ordered. And then I just finished coming up with the full course marking schedule that starts on, let's see, it starts on Tuesday and it'll go through the next week. So working out that, sending emails to volunteers, and then I get a lot of questions this time of year about lots of random stuff.
Speaking of random questions, okay, Don has probably not, he's thought about his fitness and whether he can finish the race or do well at the race. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether he's thought about the whole logistics of a 200-mile race. Have you?
Well,
what kind of tips can you give him as a race director of people that have completely come not prepared? That's what I'm looking for Don is.
You're assuming I'm not prepared, Scott.
Before the podcast, I will be fair to you. Before the podcast, he asked me for my trekking poles, and so we have the trekking poles here in Studio G. He's sized them up, and he's ready to go. Ooh, with the trekking poles. So you're thinking a little bit.
Well, I'm thinking I should try them out tomorrow on a run.
Yeah, I think that's a smart thing to do. What other things or advice?
No, you're a couple weeks out.
Other advice would you give someone running their first 200-mile race?
Well, honestly, I'm always surprised how inexperienced some people come into it. No offense, Don.
No problem. None taken. I sit across the table from Scott War.
No, but actually you're good to go. But no, thanks. I recently got an email from somebody who's just signed up for one of my marathons, and they were even asked, this is in November, and they were asking me what the weather's going to be like. I was like, yeah, just questions like that. And it worries me. It worries me a lot. But you, Don, I think are solid. I guess my advice would be, don't wait till the last minute to sort of study the maps and the sections of trail, because there are a few sections that are going to be longer and you'll want to mentally prepare for like a 20-mile section without, sometimes that can take a long time in a 200. If you're moving at our cutoff time, you could be moving at less than 2 miles an hour and still make the finish. So the good news is that you shouldn't panic. I think the most important thing for somebody who's new to it is to to really not worry and not get too stressed out about it. You know, it's think about it as a long hike in the mountains. And if you feel like running, great. But that's not necessarily a requirement. I think with the cutoff, you could hike the whole thing and still finish as long as you don't sleep very much.
I still get to call it a run, though, right, Candace?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, it's definitely a run. No, there'll be running involved for sure. But I would say, you know, the first hill on the Tahoe 200 is very steep, the ski hill. Take that easy. People are going to take off. They always do. And just sort of let people go. And then you'll start catching them on, you know, as you enjoy yourself on the rest of the course. But making sure you have enough calories and food or calories and water, all the things that you would do in 100 just multiplied. You don't want to let any chafing start to happen. So you want to stay up on that because that people quit because of chafing sometimes. I mean, at 200, it can be a long time out there.
Oh, yeah. No, I plan on having plenty of anti-chafe going on. I mean, I'll be the guy that looks like a greased pig. This will take
you back to your bodybuilding days when you used to grease yourself down for competition. You'll look like that guy.
Yeah, that's what I'll do.
Were you a bodybuilder?
There was a time that maybe I lifted a little heavy.
Great.
So what was I going to ask? You threw me off with that bodybuilding thing, Scott.
Sorry.
Okay.
He gets embarrassed when I bring that up.
So I want to talk about the spot because that's something I need. And I want to talk about GPS coordinates. I think that you can upload a map of some kind because one of the things I would worry about being out there by myself is, hey, I'm making a left-hand turn when I should go right, and I'm not really interested in doing that.
Uploading it where? Onto the spot?
Onto your phone, right? You can
upload, your phone.
Yeah. Are you using your phone?
Well, listen to what Candace is about
okay,
to tell you.
Okay. I'm just questioning using your phone.
Well, what we found is, you know, through lots of, I had been like the race director and having to map out the course, I had a more expensive GPS device. And so I would recommend people get a GPS device. But as more people started running the race, I was informed that you could just download this program to your phone, have it on airplane mode. And then if you have like some of those little mini chargers in drop bags, you can charge your phone as you go. You could even carry it in your pack if you needed to. But the thing about a 200 is we mark the course better than some people mark, you know, a half marathon. So it's going to be marked really well. And about 95% of the time, or maybe the whole time, you won't have to worry about anything. But it is 200 miles, and there's a high likelihood that a section may be pulled down. Not a lot of sections, but it's possible. And so we like to let people know that because I'd rather that you know that it's a possibility before you get out there, you know, and you're pushing hard and you're overstressed, just knowing that and having some way of dealing with it. I'm definitely more of a fan of GPS than maps because what happens with maps is that you will pull them out only once you're lost. So you have no idea where you are, you know, and with a GPS, you have to know how to use it, obviously.
That's a problem, Candace, because I don't even know what it looks like at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so what I did is I posted on our Tahoe 200 running group page. Are you a member of that yet?
Do I have to be invited or can I just join it?
You can join it, but then I have to accept you.
Oh, okay. Will you accept
me? I'll accept you.
Okay.
This is on Facebook?
Yeah, like, you know how Facebook has pages, but it also has groups?
Yeah.
Right.
So for each of the 200s, we also have a group. And the group is more of a forum, whereas a page, you know, it's hard to make a page a forum. And so on the group, I have a lot of stuff, like I'll put all the runner emails on there as documents and then information on how to download the maps to your phone, that kind of thing.
So have many people used the phone and find that that's a pretty good resource?
Yes, okay. They love it. Absolutely love it.
Now, is it something that I plug like a headset in my ear and it'll tell me if I'm off the course or do I have to watch it like a roadmap or what do I do?
No,
I just don't know.
The only time you need to use it is if you get to an intersection and there's no markings or if you've been going for a while and you're like, shoot, I haven't seen a marker. Candace says they're going to be every quarter mile and I haven't seen one in a half mile. Maybe you get worried. You can pull it out and just check and it'll show you where you are on the map. along with the course.
Oh, cool.
So really you should, I mean, generally people who have it on their phone will pull it out a couple of times during the race.
Nice.
And it works on airplane mode.
Yes.
So you don't use all your battery.
Exactly.
Very cool. Okay. Well,
we'll have to get you some of those little battery chargers.
I've got some of those.
Do you?
Yeah, yeah.
We'll have to get you some of those because I'm going to be texting you the whole way.
Thanks. I'll be listening to Trail Runner Nation podcast trying to, what did Sock Doc say about that? I got to check that out. What do I do with this blister? Okay. All right. So we wanted to talk about that trekking poles. How many people are using trekking poles? Is it mandatory that I have these or what should I do?
I've been waiting for you to ask that question.
Were you really?
So the question is how many people are using poles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, I haven't polled them about it yet.
How many have you seen? That's funny.
Yeah. Nice pun.
You like that?
Yeah.
No, I think, if I was to guess, I would say that, maybe 60 to 70% use poles, maybe 75 to 80. But yeah, I'm not totally sure. It would be interesting to do some sort of a survey. I won't say poll.
Don't say it.
after the race and see what people use and how many people use crew and pacers. Because I do know we have a number of people who come out just by themselves, no crew, no pacers. And we've designed the aid stations so that, you know, the people working there are going to attend to your needs. So you don't have to have a crew. And you don't have to have pacers. It's more of an option.
Yeah, I'm going pacerless is my, unless Scott shows up and wants to run some with me. And I'm going pacerless.
Scott. I may.
Gotta help that.
I want to go through the gear checklist. I think we did this a little bit on the first part of the podcast.
Well, now we have Candace here, but she wrote the list.
Yeah, she wrote the list. So a waterproof rain jacket with a hood. Plastic bags do not count. Oh, right. I like that. So you have the Houdini,
yeah,
right? So you're good
ready
there.
To go.
Okay. Long sleeve insulated shirt, wool or microfiber, no cotton.
So when do we show you all of this stuff, Candace? Do we have to, like a Marine? When I was in the Marine Corps, we had things that people, we were inspected. We laid it all out in specific order. And then,
I don't think she's going to check.
You're not going to check? Is the honor system?
Okay. Well, so the first year we did the Tahoe 200, we had mandatory gear. But if you'll notice, it says recommended now.
No, it says highly recommended.
Oh, right. So we don't check it anymore.
Okay.
I just felt like if you're doing a 200, you're an adult. You can hopefully take care of yourself. And so the only race I have mandatory gear now for is the Bigfoot races I have in October because the weather can be so unpredictable.
Yeah.
And our experience last year. But that's a whole nother podcast.
We'll save it. We'll save that topic. But I can see on some of those, it's just good to check because you think you have it and you don't. It's really a favor to the runner more than a disciplinary counseling.
Right.
Yeah.
So either a long sleeve shirt, you have some sleeves.
Yeah. I'll bring the TRN sleeves.
Yeah.
You've seen those, right, Candace?
Oh, they're great. They're soft. They're so nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving on, waterproof pants. You don't have any waterproof pants.
No, I don't.
Does he need waterproof pants, Candace, really?
No, not unless, here's the thing. These are sort of based on what the weather may be. Like if we were supposed to have thunderstorms, which is very unusual.
Yeah, in Tahoe.
In early September, it can happen. But if the weather was going to be something like that, then I would recommend that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So hat and gloves.
Got it.
Water purification method.
Yes.
Do you have something like that?
I'm going to get a Steri-Stick. I think those are...
A Steri-Stick?
What is it called?
A Steri-Pen.
Steri-Pen.
Yeah. I have one you can use.
Thank you.
I have a
I've already got a crew. A look at this. I've got a crew. I've got Scott and Candace.
I also if you decide Scott's poles are too heavy, I have some lighter weight ones maybe.
Oh, okay. Yours aren't any lighter than mine, Candace.
These are carbon.
Oh, you got carbon. Okay. I can't tell.
Look at me. Lift it as if it weighs nothing.
Okay.
Oh, that's awesome.
So
great.
So moving on, you need a list of emergency contacts with your allergies and medical condition, yada yada.
Okay.
A headlamp. We assume that you would
bring the Petzl with mini rechargeables.
So we need to make sure all the batteries are charged up, right?
Got it.
$20 cash and a debit card.
Yeah, what's with these aid stations? How much do you charge for refilling the bottles?
How much do you tip the aid station workers?
Well, so for the first, you probably don't need that for like the first 70 miles, but with the rest of the course, you know, if you were for some reason to get off course, or, you know, you went down toward the lake, which is also off course, you would at least have like a card and some money to buy and, you know, like get back to where you need to go.
Call,
I mean, it's
call an
it's,
Uber.
I exactly. I always bring stuff like that with me just in case. But for the first like 70 miles, it wouldn't help you one bit.
Oh, thanks.
Because you're like out in the middle of nowhere.
You know, if you run out of water, you could always, you know, get one of the other runners coming by. You say, hey, I'll pay $20 for anyway.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay. So now this is something I'm concerned about. I'm questioning what your strategy is here. The ability to carry 40 ounces of water.
Yes, I want to talk about that.
So you don't like the hydration bladders.
I'm going hydration pack. I'm going Oh, yeah. And I want to talk to Candace about
You need to train with
Ultimate Direction is the brand that I've selected. That's the one I want. But I'm trying to decide between that. There's the Scott Jurek one and the Anton Kropitschka one. And one, yeah,
I have the Anton one.
You do?
Yeah, I'll give it to you.
Well, look at he's giving me his poles. I don't know if I'm going to get credit for running this thing.
I hope I do for giving you all my stuff.
Well, so the Anton pack is a little small, I think, to carry like a jacket, stuff like that.
Okay, then I'm going the Jurek one. Which one do you have, Anton?
Yeah, I would at least go with the Jurek. They have adventure. They have an adventure Vesta.
Yeah,
that's pretty, or adventure vest.
I think
that's
the one
cool.
I have.
That would be perfect.
I have it in my truck.
You do?
Yeah. Do you want to see it?
Well, not right now. We're talking to Candace.
Well, I can run to my truck and get it, and we can have Candace approve it right on podcast.
I could model it.
You could.
Wait. Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
Well, and the other one, the Peter Bachwin vest, the PB vest, is one that's really
that's the one I have.
Popular.
The PB. I have the PB.
Oh,
you don't know what you have.
I have the PB.
Is that the best one, Candace?
That's the one I've used for a ton of this kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, a lot of people also use the Ultimate Direction 20-liter fast pack. Mm. And they fill it up. Like, they were coming through the finish line at the Bigfoot. And I, like, picked that pack up. I was just shocked. Like, what do you have in here? You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, Scott's going out to his truck right now. I don't know what all is in his truck. But every time we ask, he says, well, I'll be right back. He had the poles. He had the...
Nice.
Keep your stuff. Okay, so how many ounces is it going to... I know you're not supposed to know the weather, but you got surprised with some heat at Bigfoot, did you not?
We had, so on day one and two, the temperatures were over 100 on the trail. We measured it at the finish line, it was at 103. At one point, that was even later on, it was hotter earlier. But I was working some of the earlier aid stations. So I think I was told it was definitely up to like 110. There's some little canyons as you go through. It's very unusual there, but 90s is normal for Bigfoot. Not too crazy. 80s, 90s.
And how about Tahoe, the ranges there?
Tahoe, for the first couple sections, you'll have those that get a little hotter. You go out into the Crystal Basin, which is west of Lake Tahoe. And it can get up to, it's usually like on a hot day, maybe 80s, which isn't too bad. But it could be 90s, could be. Less likely, though. And nighttime, it can get down into the 30s.
Scott, this is really nice.
I know.
Which one is this?
That's the PB, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that looks like it. It's a different color. Mine's blue and gray.
Mine's the first edition, I think.
Yeah, well, I can run
that'll
first
work.
Edition. Yeah, what do you have?
So you don't necessarily need to use... Oh, actually, that's the tag. I kept it in there.
Oh, okay. Directions.
All right.
I like it.
Are you going to use a hydration bladder, or are you going to use the
I'm going hydration bladder, and then I'll...
For the bottles.
And I'll put a bottle up front. I don't want to carry bottles for 200 miles in my hand. That takes...
Okay.
No.
Just the
and you can't use it with your trekking poles.
That's
right,
true.
Right, right. Yeah. So I'll And if it's if there's some long stretches out there, I'll prepare for that, and I'll have bladder and bottles for the long, long stretches.
Try I don't know if you've tried the soft flask bottles. They're compressible once you drink all the water out of them.
Yeah,
and
I've seen those.
Yeah, they're a lot nicer than the hard bottles now. Ultimate Direction makes them, and then you can put other things in your pocket once you drink your water, which is pretty nice.
Yeah.
So you can check those out.
I'll do it. I'll go down and get some.
So I want to talk about sleep stations.
All right.
Don has never run a race where he's intentionally planned sleep.
I have laid down on the trail and followed the ants coming up my leg, and at a certain point decided it was time to get up.
In all fairness, he didn't lay down in the middle of the trail. He moved off to the side so people could pass.
Of course.
It's
trail etiquette, Scott.
Talk to us about sleep strategy. What should we recommend for Don for sleep strategy?
Yes. Candace?
Well, I think that's something that you sort of have to learn. I'm just sorry to say it. Well, so some people seem to do fine with the 200 mile, like figuring out the sleep. When I did one, I struggled with it a lot. The more I slept, the more tired I felt. I think it would have been better for me to try to push through instead of trying to sleep a lot. But that was just me personally. I think if you're hallucinating a lot, does happen. If you're hallucinating a lot or dealing with other issues like that, it's the, you know, more extreme issues, it's definitely a good idea. All right, maybe I'll sleep a little. But I know people who go through the whole thing without sleeping, and that's their strategy. I don't know how they do it, but and then the front runners usually will get somewhere around an hour of sleep. And if they're really good, they can knock off 15 minutes, you know, here and there, and that'll give them just enough to keep going. You sort of have to embrace the just that weird different world you step into when you're not getting proper sleep and you're in this, you know, trail world. And so a lot of people just love that, you know, it's a different situation. I don't quite know how to describe it, but it'll be interesting to talk to you afterwards.
we'll have Don try to explain it after he finishes.
We'll do a follow up. That'll be good.
That would be fun. Yeah.
So, but he doesn't have to bring in his pack any, like, a sleeping bag or anything to sleep. He can just, I mean, you have like a nice blanket that he can lay down on the ground.
Yeah, we do. We'll have, this year we've upgraded most of our sleep stations. Will have multiple large, like 8 to 10 person tents, enough that there'll be plenty of space. I mean, if you're sleeping in a tent, you have trouble sleeping in noisier situations, I always recommend earplugs because people will be coming in and out and cheering and that kind of thing. But usually when you have to sleep in a 200, you're tired enough that...
That's not an issue.
Yeah, you either sleep on... A lot of people sleep on the trail. That's why I always bring like a down jacket with me when I'm doing these longer runs, because then you can just curl up on the trail too. It doesn't sound comfortable, but you'd be surprised. I've managed to feel pretty comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
I think you slept.
Oh, when I was...
Yeah.
I'm sure I did, because I woke up and the race was over and the sweepers came by and there weren't any tags left on the trees.
Oh, no.
That's not true. That's not true.
I embellished the story a little bit.
That's not true.
Oh.
But he did sleep.
I probably did. So, well, I'm super excited about it, Candace. I mean, I was on the fence for a very, very long time just because... You know, I could, like anybody else, I could come up with a lot of reasons, and I've been beaten up in a 100-mile run, as we all have that have been out there. I mean, I've been beat up in a 50-mile run,
and
to the point where I thought I would never go another step than 50, and then I did the 100, and I got beat up there. And so I'm thinking, how do I have another 100 after the 100? Well, that's the same thing I thought about after a marathon. How did I have another step after that?
How can you go 50K?
So with that logic, I said a 200 must be doable.
But Don, do you remember like did you go from like 50K to 50 mile or how did you?
Right. Yeah, I did. I did the traditional stair step.
So do you remember like when you went from 50K to 50 mile and the feeling when you're past that 50K, you're like, whoa, you know, like, whoa.
Yeah.
And then you reach that 50 mile goal. And I think for a lot of people, 200s are sort of that new thing. We know we can do 100 or maybe we haven't even done 100, because I do have some runners who qualify in different kinds of ways, but they have that desire to sort of push past and have a completely different kind of adventure. And I think what it really comes down to, at some point you're going to want to quit. And maybe at lots of different points. And what you have to remember in the 200s is that means you just have to start taking a little bit better care of yourself. So maybe you take a little nap instead of quitting. You eat more food. It usually just means that you have to come back to your into yourself and figure out what do you need to keep going. For one guy, it was tequila. You know, he just started. He had like a shot at tequila each aid station, and it was just enough to just take the edge off and keep him going.
Now is this on the required checklist of items
to
bring?
It's not on the highly recommended.
We'll add it.
With lime and the salt, the whole thing. Yeah. You got to do it right.
Well, you got to get your electrolytes in.
Sure.
That's right. Well, we're going to put a surprise aid station for runners on the last downhill to the finish. So yeah, you can look forward to that too. And it'll just be like something like that, you know, don't expect a bunch of food.
Now, Candace, I've got to say that, you know, we've all looked at the great pictures and images that come from your races, mm-hmm. because one, it's just the views are spectacular. The places that you've set these races in are just amazing. But the other amazing thing is it looks like everybody's having a great time. And you make a fun atmosphere out of that. And that's one of the reasons I said, yeah, I want to do it. It's because you do make it look fun.
They don't take pictures of the ones that are suffering, Don.
We have some of those, but it makes the suffering even look fun. It's the key is having a good photographer.
Howie Stern.
Howie Stern is a good photographer. Howie Stern,
yeah. And for Tahoe, I mean, we make sure that we have good people out there capturing your guys' good and bad moments. But I think really, and we have to remember too, when we're out on the trail, and maybe we don't want to keep going, you know, we signed up for this. Like, you want that whole experience. You want that moment of like, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. I'm not doing it. And you want to get through that. And that's the moment. Once you get through that and you finally say, all right, I'm doing this, you know, no matter what, that's the empowering moment. So to quit before that happens is just, I've done it. I've quit before that moment happens. And it's always like, shouldn't have quit.
You know, Candace, I think you're inspiring many, many 100-mile finishers to consider the next distance.
Yes.
And as more and more people do it, I think it becomes more achievable and something that's within reach. And so I think your 200 distance is really going to catch fire even more than it already has. And so I'm looking forward for it to grow. And I thought it was so cool when I went to Ultra Sign Up and it gave me all the distance of the races and they're set the 200 mile distance. And I thought, that's Candace that did that.
Yeah.
That 200 mm-hmm. belongs to her vision and her idea. And I thought, how cool is that? And we get to talk to her.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
You know, it's funny because I was looking at Ultra Science page there and there was no 200 mile option. And so I emailed Mark and I was like, Mark, listen, you know, I'm a good client of yours. I have a lot of races.
Yes.
It's like, can you put the 200 on there? And he said, yeah, I'll put it on there. I was like, yes.
I think Mark should do it. Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was going to. He was going to. And then he backed out. So.
So
pull a Mark.
Oh, I won't. No, I won't. Hey, let's talk about this last thing because you need to get some sleep to get this trail marked. There's a lot of miles out there
and
lot of ribbons to hang. And doggone it, I don't want to be the reason that the one I need isn't up there. Okay. So
smart man.
So what about if I do have some crew and somebody comes up and they want to try to find the runners? How accessible is it to crew to kind of join them? How much is remote and how much is accessible?
Yeah, so we actually, just because of Forest Service regulation, we don't allow crew for the first, it's like 64 miles.
Yeah. You don't need crew then anyway.
No, and plus, I mean, it's like Tahoe. They get to go to the beach and the casino and, you know, all these great restaurants. So the crew's like, yes. So Sierra Tahoe is our first crew access aid station. And then the rest are really accessible, actually. The lake, cool. That's one of the great things about the Tahoe 200, especially compared to the Bigfoot, which is really hard to get to the aid stations. They're so remote. But here, when you're on the trail, you feel remote. But for your crew, they don't have to drive super far. So that's really nice. Really, really crew accessible.
And all of the runners, the spot map that you have is accessible to crew, so they can all at any given time find out where their runner is.
That's what's so great. We decided to require everybody have one this year so that we wouldn't have mystery runners out there. And it's on trackleaders.com. And then in the next week or so, they'll put up our page, which will be the Tahoe 200 page. You can look back at the Bigfoot one from last month. And it's really cool. You can see as people like catch up to each other. And
wow.
And especially for a course like Bigfoot or Tahoe, where you're not, it's really clear where the course goes. There's no loops or overlaps, you know, so you know exactly who's in the lead. Yeah, as compared to like a spiderweb course.
Yeah, that's very cool. So is there still time? Oh, go ahead, Scott.
I just had a question.
Is it a good one?
From a race director standpoint that has done Bigfoot a couple years, Tahoe 3 years?
This will be the third?
This will be the third, yeah.
Which is easier to manage, a point-to-point like Bigfoot or a circumnavigation like Tahoe?
Circumnavigation's way easier.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, well, because Tahoe's not as remote. And that's one of the great things about Bigfoot is that it's so remote and it's so incredibly varied terrain. But they don't make roads for our course. So you might have to drive like all the way up and around this way and then all the way back and around. And a lot of the roads get ruined each winter due to extreme conditions. So that makes it an amazing course for the runners, but definitely for crew or for us organizing it. If I have to send resupply out to Council Bluff, it could be a 4-hour drive one way.
Wow.
For our resupply people. So I have to have enough employees on hand to make sure that we can get stuff out like an 8-hour drive. So with Tahoe being a big loop, we only have to manage one finish line, start line. With Bigfoot, we have to bus everybody out, get the buses out on time. And then we have a whole start line we set up and a whole finish line. So it's Bigfoot is almost, I mean, in some ways it feels like twice the work for sure.
Now, I had a question, but I forgot what it was, Scott, and it was a good one. All right.
When is the last time you can drop out?
No. It's along those lines of, if somebody's listening to this now and said, you know what?
Oh, yeah.
I'm getting off the fence. If Freeman can do it, heck, I'm getting in there and doing it too.
You have 2 weeks.
Yeah. Time enough to taper.
Yeah.
That's right. Plenty of time. So, all you need to do is taper.
That's all I've got. It's my training as a taper. No. So tell me, Candace, is there room left? Did I get the last spot or do you still have room for some runners?
We do still have room. We have, I think we have about 111 people, which will actually be the largest 200 ever in the United States, which is exciting. But we have our permits for 140. So there's still a lot. We're not going to fill up this year. There's plenty of spaces, but registration will close August 31st because we need to finish printing all our documents and get everything in order. So if somebody wants to sign up, make sure you do it before September 1.
That's awesome. You know, I mean, it's not too late to get in. And by the sounds of what you're talking about, the race is so well put together that you don't necessarily have to be in the top shape of your life, race shape. You just need to be a smart runner and go out there and be in shape and travel, you know. So, wow, what an opportunity. So I look forward to doing it.
Yeah, it gives people a whole range. You could come in, you know, as a super trained athlete, and run as fast as you want, or you could come in for more of the recreational experience and just eat as much as you can at every aid station, get as much sleep as possible, have a beer at every station, you know.
Or tequila.
The whole range. So and that's what I have the cutoff set for, so that even somebody who hasn't necessarily done a bunch of hundreds or anything like that, they could still come in and finish. I mean, I had a guy last year finish the 200 his longest run was 35 miles.
Wow.
Yeah, which is crazy. But he was a friend, so I was like, well.
now, what is it I'm supposed to bring the race director? I know that you have crazy items that I need to go gather, and I don't know if I have time enough to get them all. But what are some of the lead items I need?
Well, so that's mostly for Bigfoot. We have Bigfoot is special. For Bigfoot, runners have to send me 12 ounces of whole bean coffee, preferably a dark roast, as well as a Bigfoot item.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't grind it so far in advance. It's just gross by coffee snob. Yeah, so that for Bigfoot, we require that. And then we have at the awards ceremony, we'll have a special, we give out a bunch of those Bigfoot awards for, you know, different, it's pretty fun. For we come up with different things based on what different runners went through and on the course and volunteers. But for Tahoe, the tradition for Tahoe is to bring me a 6-pack of local beer.
Okay.
And that was started by, that was for good luck. And Stephen Jones started that a couple years ago. I think he was trying to get on my good side. And he said he spread this rumor on Facebook that if you bring a 6-pack, you'll have good luck. And it worked for him every year. So he finished it every year and just passed away this past February in an avalanche, actually. So. Yeah. This year, actually, for the Tahoe 200, we have an aid station that's the last aid station named after him. And about 5 or 6 of his family members are going to be running that aid station
with
some other ultra runners. So
That'll be a special aid station.
Yeah,
well, and then you'll only be, I think it's like 12 or 13 miles from the finish. So
sweet. Okay. Well, Candace, thank you for putting in the effort of creating this insane event called Tahoe 200. I'm wearing the hat now and almost feeling guilty because I haven't earned it yet, but I will go out there and earn it. And I'm excited about it.
Now go, you need to go find a sleep station yourself and get some sleep.
Yeah, I do. I'm so tired. Well, thanks guys. Thanks for chatting about 200s.
Yep. I'll see you September 9th at the mandatory meeting and I'll have my seat right up front.
September 8th.
It's 8th?
It's 8th.
That's totally Don. He misses the day that he's supposed to be there.
That is so me. Okay.
Well, at least I know what day it is. I mean, that's probably a little more important.
Do you know where Tahoe is?
Yes,
I do. It's that way.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I've got your poles. I've got your pack, and I'm ready to roll. I will have PEKs, and I'll bring extra for anybody that's up there that needs them.
Well, we'll bring a PEK for everybody that's running.
Yeah, we'll have a bunch.
There we go. We can hand them out at check-in.
Good. I'll bring a whole bunch on the 8th when I show up.
At the 8th.
Now, I will go out and run
super 200 mile
Moss.